Welcome to the sixth episode of From Newts to Newton, featuring our special guest, Simon Partridge.
In this episode, we'll be talking about everything from touch within virtual reality to frat boy startups.
From AI ending the world to Silicon Valley social responsibility.
From US working culture to universal basic income. Welcome to From Newts to Newton. Hello and welcome to the sixth episode of From Newts to Newton. This is a British themed episode. We all have cups of tea with milk. And with us, we have another Brit. We have Simon Partridge, who is a two-time summer intern at the company Ultra Haptics, which is based in the UK, but is outreaching, creating offices in the Silicon Valley. Hello, Simon. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Robert. Hello, Ross. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for being on the show.
So you work basically in VR. Can you give us a flavour of what exactly you work on with regard to it?
So the company I'm working for do mid-air touch. So we have a device that creates vibrations on your skin without you having to touch anything. So we're looking to use VR or to improve VR by adding the sense of touch to it. So currently the VR experience is very visual and audio based, and if we can add another sense to that, it creates a much more immersive experience and a much more kind of satisfying experience for people using it.
So you're taking VR from the realm of sight and sound, and you're taking it into touch, which is kind of important, isn't it? Because it's kind of like when you're using VR, you have your hands in front of you, and one of the most jarring aspects of it is that you can't actually feel anything, right?
Yeah. And right now, the only sort of feel that you get is from the haptic feedback that the controllers get, and that's just a vibration.
Yeah.
And so it's not really a feel or like a resistance. It's just a stimulus that happens when you touch an object. This is actually like a resistance that you can feel, or
so we can't provide resistance, but we can provide a sensation of mm-hmm. touch. So
there's, but it's much more
there's not a force being pressed, but it's much more. There's a much higher resolution than a controller. We can locate specific bits of the hand and give touch to certain areas at different frequencies to give you different sensations. And the work is still going on with figuring out precisely what kind of sensations can be made and to what how realistic they can be. And there's a lot of research going on to figure out how to do it better, basically.
So can you give us a few more details as to exactly how the system works?
So what we use is an array of ultrasound transducers, which are actually from car reversing systems. And we just take a whole load of them, 256 in the case of one of our devices, and we arrange them in an array, and then they resonate at a certain frequency, and you can create constructive interference to create a point of high pressure in the air. And that point of high pressure can then be turned off and on, which gives you a vibration in the air. And if we make that vibration be at the surface of the skin, then that moves the nerves in your skin and you feel something. So exactly how touch works is when you touch something, you get a sense of what the material is through vibration. So you struggle to feel what things are when your hand is static on it, and to actually feel something you have to move your hand across the surface. And you're then able to feel through the kind of change over time as to what that surface is like, and that's pretty much what we do.
So going a little bit more into the physics of it, if you're not able to answer, that's absolutely fine. We're happy to delete anything that is embarrassing. So ultrasound transducers, what exactly are they and how do they work?
So my knowledge on this is somewhat limited, but they're a piezoelectric transducer. So they have a ceramic inside them that when given electrical current will vibrate, and they vibrate at a pretty high frequency, so 40 kilohertz. And the surface of that will vibrate and will cause a vibration in the air, which gives you ultrasound.
So it's pretty simple, to be honest. You just pass a current through, it goes poof, poof, poof. At a certain frequency, and you're creating those standing waves above it.
Yeah, I mean, if you talk to people who make transducers, I'll tell you it's not very simple. But in principle, it's fairly simple to do. But the realities of manufacturing transducers is probably quite a different story.
Mm-hmm. And what are the frequencies that you're projecting?
So the carrier frequency is 40 kilohertz, but your sense of touch ranges from about 20 hertz up to maybe 400 hertz. So the sense that you can actually feel and detect changes in. So much faster than that, and you can't pick it up. And much lower than that, you also can't really pick it up. So the carrier frequency is 40 kilohertz, but the actual vibration we end up producing is somewhere within that range of what we can feel. And we found that higher frequencies tend to give you a feeling of a more precise point and a finer kind of point of contact, and lower frequencies are the opposite, give you a bigger object. So there's a lot of tricks to be played with when you're playing with VR, to do with if you're touching a kind of small light object, then you might use a higher frequency vibration, whereas a bigger, heavier object, you'd use a lower frequency vibration, because they tend to have those properties in the real world, and there's a certain expectation as to what you'd feel when you touch an object of a certain type.
And how loud are, and what's the amplitude of these, of the sounds, like at 40 kilohertz and so?
So, basically we're trying to minimize audible frequencies.
Right.
So in theory, we should make it as quiet as possible. And you'll hear the device when we use it. It's pretty quiet, and there's various things we're looking into to make it quieter. Mm-hmm. As for sound pressure, I think it's about 140 decibels of ultrasound in the air, which equates to about a gram of force. That's pretty much what it is.
Mm. And when we were talking a little bit earlier about this, but you guys are testing whether or not certain animals are going to be able to detect it, because dogs have a much higher sensitivity at higher frequencies, so I imagine that they might be able to hear or be more sensitive to things at 40 kilohertz. Like, for example, seals could definitely hear, in 140, if it's 140 decibels, they could definitely hear it in air, 140 decibels at 40 kilohertz.
So, yeah, I think as your as the frequency goes up into ultrasound, the response of the eardrum tends to be a lot lower. So as humans, we can't hear much over kind of 20 kilohertz or so.
Right.
And so even if you do are able to hear it, it's a lot quieter because the higher frequencies get attenuated more. So you can't hear it as loudly, I think. But yeah, in our experimentation, I don't know how much has been done, but we haven't found any problems thus far.
Yeah, I guess.
So we have a device with us. In fact, we have a prototype of what would you call this specific device?
we call it an array, I think.
An array.
The array.
The array, yeah.
So it basically looks like, what does it look like? It's just a bunch of cylinders that are set out on a sort of circuit board kind of deal. And it looks pretty simple from the outside. But are you able to show us sort of exactly how it works? Ross has never experienced this before, so we'll see what he thinks.
What do you mean by how it works?
So basically, what do you do to induce the sensation so that Ross can do it?
So we're using, to provide the feedback, we have to track your hand, to know where your hand is, as to know where to create the points of high pressure. So we're using a product called Leap Motion, which just uses two stereoscopic infrared cameras. So much like your eyes, we can tell 3D from it.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's two cameras and you can work out the difference between the two images that you get. So using that, so if you put your hand over, this is one of our demos, is a bubble sensation. So if you put your hand over it, you'll feel the bubbles pop on your hand.
Sure. I am now about to put my hand over the array. We'll see.
Experiment one of From Newton to Newton. His face has a look of abject curiosity. It's quite interesting. Is there an ideal height? Are you able to vary the height much? So his hand is currently above. He's popping loads of bubbles on the screen. Does it feel like you're popping bubbles, Ross?
It's definitely a lot more vibration you would get from popping a typical bubble, but it provides just as much joy as popping an actual bubble. Let me tell you that. And it That is super, super cool. It is not exactly what I was expecting. It really does feel like there's like an air blast that is like pushing up and like pushing on your hand at the particular part where the bubbles are showing. And right now we have a screen that displays where the bubbles are, and the leap motion tracking is tracking my hand in on the computer screen as well, so I can sort of follow it and actually be able to aim my hand and hit the bubbles. Mm-hmm. And it is incredibly intuitive, like just from what I was just this like basic just from this basic setup, you're able to like aim for the specific bubbles along the array, and the sensation is just really, really cool.
Fascinating. And we have another example of something we can do. We've got sort of a laser beam, a sort of plain laser beam emanating from the pad. So let's see what your hand feels when you put your hand in this time.
All right, force field.
Oh, hear that.
Wow, you really can't hear it.
So although it feels like, in this particular simulation to me, it feels like air is blowing on your hand, that it isn't actually the same process that is causing that sensation. It's a simulated sensation.
That's correct. They're not little fans. They're not just blowing air at you. It's a vibration in the air that's then vibrating your skin. And that's one of the things we're working on, is to try and make our sensations feel less like blowing air and more like an actual sensation. And we've got some other demos that have a much more precise kind of, we've got some buttons that make a click feeling, and you can really feel it. It feels like you're pressing an actual button. So there's a kind of, you hit the bottom of the click and then you feel a click on the way up again.
I see.
And they're a lot more kind of, more staccato kind of feeling. They click, click.
So how long do you think before something like this comes onto the VR market? Is this a long time?
Sure. I think that remains to be seen as to how quickly VR takes off, and how big the market gets. But I think something fairly soon could be there. But we're working with various people to try and we've got to have developer support basically if we want to have this stuff used. There's got to be a big enough VR market out there for it to be worth it. And there's kind of a chicken and egg problem, because you've got to have people who want to use the haptics and have the device or the peripheral that may or may not be made, but you've then got to get developers to build support into their games, and developers aren't going to build support into their games unless there's enough people out there with the device, and people aren't going to buy the device unless it's in the games. So that's something that remains to be seen as to how that gets tackled.
I'm guessing an aspect is making it simple to integrate into games as well, making the programming simple and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's something we're working a lot on, tools at the moment to make it easier to make these sensations and to design different ones, and that's something that's definitely coming along a lot, and should get a lot easier going forward to do different sensations.
These are only going to make the holograms they're only going to make the virtual reality we live in in a few years, that we live in forever and can download our brains into. It's going to make it feel even more real.
I think this is the step before we have things in the brainstem that just give you your sensations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll just be lying on a bed of this array.
No headset required, no array. You just have an implant in your brain.
Oh man, and it just sends little impulses to your nerves depending on what you want to simulate.
It's theoretically possible, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, why not? All we need to do is know enough about the brain and where to send those signals, and we could definitely do it.
So you think brainstems are the way to go?
I'm not condoning it at all, but it's got the potential to happen in the future. I think so. Wearing virtual reality headsets and augmented reality is another area that I've been looking into, and wearing one of those headsets is currently a bit of a faff because it's quite heavy and it sits over your face and you look like an idiot.
So very quickly, the difference between augmented reality and virtual reality.
So virtual reality is you have a device that fits completely over your eyes. There's a screen in there, and you're seeing the virtual world. So that's a game world usually. Although you see quite a lot of companies using it for staff training. So there was a story about KFC made a training virtual reality game for their people to cook chicken, basically. And it was a bit gruesome, I think.
I saw that. That was really creepy.
But that's quite a tool for that virtual reality has been used for quite a lot, is to be able to have people in simulated situations. But then augmented reality is you have a see-through screen, and then you're able to augment the current place you are with additional information. Mm-hmm. So you could imagine an office where there's no computer screens anymore because everyone wears a headset, and there's a virtual screen that you see, or we can work on a 3D model. So we're a car company. There's a 3D model of a car that we can both see as if it's in the room with us, but it's not there. But because we've got our headsets on, we can both see the same model, and we can work on it together, and we can, you know, use our hands to perhaps, you know, sculpt a little bit of the bodywork and say, oh, that'd be nice if that looked like this, and you can adjust the size of the wing mirrors, or, you know, the possibilities are pretty endless in terms of that.
You have, like, people doing pottery who just, like, got their hands in front of them.
So that's something we've actually looked into, because that would be quite a good demo for us, would be a pottery demo, because you're sat around a device that you can then feel the pottery sculpting underneath your hands.
So the only thing with this array is that because it's a single direction, it's just going up, you're not able to feel anything when your hand goes up, only when it's, like, going down.
That's correct, yeah. So we can target the haptics on about a 30 degree angle either side of the array, but yeah, you can only feel things from below. But what we found is the brain is really good at tricking you, and if you're expecting a certain thing, you'll feel it. So one of the things is if you're expecting to feel something on the so if you're in virtual reality and you can see an object hit the front of your hand, and you can feel an you can hear an object hit the front of the hand. And if you feel the haptic on the back of your hand, your brain is really good at tricking you into thinking you felt it on the front.
Mm-hmm. Because you're expecting the stimulus, and so it like just interprets
it. And there's definitely like a case of priming. If people are expecting a certain thing, they'll feel it. So we found that it's really good showing people a demo where that happens. And oftentimes they won't notice, and they'll say, how did you get the feeling on the back of my hand? And we'll be like, we didn't. Your brain did it.
Wow.
So that's another part of the puzzle is for creating virtual worlds, the more sensors you have kind of working together to convince you of a certain thing, the more realistic it comes. And you can rely on each of the sensors to trick each of the other sensors a bit into believing that a certain thing is real and is really there.
It's crazy. It's crazy, dude. Would you be able to put an array on top and on bottom, and so that you could have that three-dimensional feel?
Yeah, we can definitely do that. So that's, yeah, definitely possible. And the idea, so one of the things we may go into is much larger devices that can, so in the idea of an arcade where you can be in a whole room that's covered with these things and you can feel things all around you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's potentially something going forward that we could do.
Could there be some sort of alarm system as well? Because obviously the sensation is very, very noticeable, right? And perhaps, you know, more noticeable than, you know, an audio-visual warning of some sort if you're in some sort of, like, I don't know.
Yeah, so there's definitely an application for in a factory, for example, if there's a certain thing that is sometimes really hot and you don't want to touch it, that you could have this device that as you put your hand towards it, you can feel, like, a prickly sensation on your hand and you can be like, oh, I better not touch that. That's really hot.
Mm. Oh, something that, like if it had a temperature sensor and it only gave you that tingly sensation if it was at a certain temperature.
Yeah, that would definitely be
something. That'd be super cool.
That could be done.
Oh, it wouldn't be super cool. It'd be super hot.
Clutch. Super clutch.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
I would imagine this would be really cool in like movie theaters or like theme park rides where you could like have something like projected onto you where you're actually like feeling. It's almost like almost feels a little gimmicky, but you know, if there was like, you know, like the old 3D movies where they had like something coming out at you.
I gather this doesn't work with faces very well right now though.
I'm not sure we've done any work with faces. I imagine it would work with faces because your face is quite sensitive, but you have to, the ultrasound isn't damaging if it gets in your ears, but it's not very nice. You can hear it. So currently, we haven't tried working with faces.
And now for our next experiment,
face VR.
But yeah, going forward, that might be something that we can do if we can up the frequency so they're no longer in the audible range. Mm-hmm. Then there'd definitely be the potential for faces. But people are a bit more wary about putting their faces into things.
I will gladly put my face into this. I'll just wear some major ear protection.
How much does it hurt if you put your ear over that thing in particular?
Not. It doesn't really hurt. It's just not. You wouldn't do it for an extended period.
Yeah. It's possible to damage your, your cells and everything. Even if you can't audibly hear the sounds.
That's true.
I'm trying to.
You probably won't be able to do it because it relies on tracking the hand. Unless your face looks like a hand.
Okay. I'll leave it to the listener's imagination as to whether my face looks like a hand.
I think it would be a 50-50 whether or not your face looks like a hand. I'd say half of the people would think yes, half of the people would think no.
It depends what you define, right, as like looking like. I guess the color palette of my face is pretty much the color palette of my hand. And so alien looking at a picture of a hand,
that makes
a picture
sense.
Of a face would be like, you know what? Look pretty similar.
Yeah, but though it would depend if you're talking about the palm or the back of your hand, because the palm doesn't have any pigment and the back of your hand does.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I'd say the shape of your hand is much more useful for telling what's a hand and what's not.
I mean, it's
hand.
it's much more difficult for you because you don't have any pigment anyway.
My pale British hand. You've got more of a tan.
But typically, your palm of your hands will be more white than the rest of your body, and the things that make it colorful are the blood and the calluses.
So is the simple reason you don't have pigment in the palm of your hand because it won't usually be exposed to the sun?
I have no clue why we don't have pigments in our hands.
Oh,
or melanin is what I mean. But
what's the point in having the biologist here?
Well, I'm not a human evolutionary biologist.
That's really cool. So Simon, how have you enjoyed spending a year in California?
I've had a wonderful time. I've been making the most of the national parks, trying to travel as much as I can and see as many things and beautiful places I can see. I've got another 2 weeks, but I'm getting quite excited to go home, I think.
Mm-hmm. We'll be heading on the same weekend back to the UK. I'll be flying straight to Manchester, and Simon will be flying back to Bristol?
Back to London, actually.
Back to London via Dublin.
Oh, nice.
Is there anything that's sort of like, I don't know, is there any interesting differences between UK and Californian culture that you've noticed in particular?
I would say that even though the West Coast is, people are quite chilled out here, I'd say the work environment and even the social environment is a lot more full on. Life's a lot busier here, I'd say, which is kind of nice, but you have to escape to the national parks to find some peace and quiet and some chilling out time.
And where exactly were you working? You're working in the city?
I'm working in Palo Alto.
In Palo Alto?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Everywhere in that, I imagine everywhere in the Silicon Valley area is super busy.
Yeah, the roads are crazy. I've seen some crazy people driving.
Yeah.
I witnessed a fight the other day between two people driving up the freeway throwing coffee at each other out the windows.
Throwing coffee at each other?
Yeah, it was madness.
Wait, we talking about like a latte or frappuccino? What kind of coffee are we talking about?
I couldn't tell. I dropped back a bit because I didn't want to get involved in an accident with these coffee maniacs.
There was
a flask of coffee and the flask ended up on the road and like flew past me.
Those frappuccinos, the most Silicon Valley thing ever.
Yeah, exactly.
A frappuccino fight on the highway.
They'd have to go through the drive-thru at Starbucks just to like get a
to refill.
Just to reload.
It's quite interesting as well because you've experienced the same company both in the UK and the United States. So basically the same, overarching company structure in two different countries. So you're perfectly placed to compare directly the working culture between those two places.
Yeah, I'd say so. Although the company has grown quite a lot since I worked for them last summer. They've now got 100 or so employees, and when I worked there, they had less than 50. So the company has grown quite a lot, which has caused it to change a fair bit. But yeah, it's been an interesting comparison.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things is the certainly last year, the social at work was really fun. We'd always go out on a Friday evening and go to the pub or whatever. But in Palo Alto, there's no pubs within walking distance. You have to drive there, which isn't very conducive to going to the pub.
Yes, we as Brits have a public message to all those in America. You guys need more pubs and you need to use them more. You need to have a work night out at least once a week. It's not compulsory for everyone to attend, but it should be expected.
Rant over.
Yeah, rant over.
Rant over. You don't think, but you see, but we don't call them pubs, you know?
Bars.
Yeah, so we need more bars.
You need more
because
bars.
Because if you come in here to our country and are like, you need more pubs, we're going to be like, get the hell out with your pub nonsense. So we call them bars. So, first of all, if you want to get to American communication, you need to appeal to our sense of pride and hubris.
Okay, got it. Well, Ross, when you work, do you have a social once a week?
Do I have a social once a week?
Yeah, does your work have a social once a week?
I mean, sort of. I mean, it's not like my whole work goes out, but the people at my work definitely go out at least once a week.
Oh, cool.
Definitely.
That's good. Do you go out once a week?
I mean, oh, you mean like out into the real world? By out, I thought you meant like a few of us gather in a single room in one of our houses and we drink alone. That, yes, we absolutely do. But we don't, no, I don't go out. It's too expensive.
That's the other thing, yeah. When pints are $8 or $9 like they are in Palo Alto, it's not conducive.
Yeah, it's just cheaper to drink at home and I don't got to deal with crazy people.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
I don't know.
That's another thing. Crazy people here are a lot louder.
Wait, crazy people here are louder? Higher decibels on the crazy people?
I don't know. There's a lot more shouty people on the streets in the United States, which is sad.
Oh, more shouty people.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're pretty loud here.
Yeah.
We are the boisterous country.
it's been absolutely wonderful for me as well, you know, spending a year here. The main thing that shocked me is actually how different it is, how different the culture is. Would you say that's similar for you, Simon?
Yeah, I'd say so. I hadn't taken into my head how much car is king in America, and how bad public transport was going to be. Mm-hmm. I was looking up flights, getting to the airport in Bristol, and there's a bus every 10 minutes, 24 hours a day, and that got me really excited for going back home.
I'm so excited about the buses. But genuinely, it's true, and although the trains cost a lot in the UK, they're a lot faster and they're a lot more prevalent. I think that's the usual method of transport for students in the UK is, I'd say only about 10% of people own a car, of students own a car, sorry. So that's how we get around. But it's been wonderful for both of us. We've both met some wonderful people, some wonderful Americans. Yeah, which we're going to keep in contact with for the rest of our lives, Ross.
Yeah, what Americans are you going to keep in contact with?
Well, I don't know. There's this really nice guy. He's called Ross. I think we've had a blast together. But we have at least one more episode before we say our goodbyes. This is now a public service announcement.
We haven't released that you're going to be leaving and that this podcast will be ending.
Yeah, that's true. So in 2 weeks' time, as Simon has alluded to, I will be making my way back to the mother country, back to the United Kingdom. And that will probably signal a good time to end this wonderful thing that has been this podcast. So we'll probably be able to get out one more episode, would you say, Ross?
Yeah, definitely one more episode.
One more. We have like lots and lots of spare material. We actually went on a trip all the way down to Monterey. We sat on the beach a couple of times and we looked at the seals and we looked at the whales and we discussed it with the wind.
We saw a breaching humpback whale.
Sounds mm-hmm. romantic.
A giant winged New Englander.
So we definitely need to somehow release that at some point. You know, some of that. We took about 4 hours worth of footage, but
at least
we need to release some of that. But yeah,
Simon, I have a quick question for you.
Uh-huh.
What made you get into this? What made you get into this crazy acoustics array VR technology?
Somewhat through chance, actually. I was looking for an internship last year, and there's a startup incubator in Bristol, and I met the guy who ran that at a conference, and I asked him if any of their startups were looking for interns over the summer, and I gave him my CV, and he forwarded it on to a bunch of startups. And I got a few emails from people looking to interview me, and I saw these guys, and I'd heard of them, they're a spin-out from my university, and it sounded like really interesting stuff. So, yeah, just kind of through chance and a bit of luck.
You must have had a good CV.
Maybe, well, yeah, presumably.
And do you want to continue your work in this sort of field, or do you have ideas elsewhere?
I don't know. I'm all a bit lost with what to do in my life at the moment. But yeah,
welcome to the club.
I think it's certainly a really interesting area. I think it's got a lot of potential to improve our interactions with computers and make everything more natural and easier to use. And I certainly think augmented reality is going to be a big part of work and education in the future. I think adding touch to augmented reality makes it a much better experience, because rather than just kind of grabbing at things that you can see in the air, you can actually feel a click as you hit a button, or a sensation as you grab something. And I think that makes it a much more compelling experience. And I think the power of education with this stuff is really compelling. Having done, there's a demo I did in virtual reality of a solar system, and you are in the solar system and you can jump around and you can pick up the planets and you can throw the planets and you can see, you get a sense of the scale of stuff, and it just gives you a much better impression. Rather than looking at a textbook, you can actually hold Jupiter in one hand and the Earth in another and compare the size of the two, and that just helps you so much more understand how things are. So I think, yeah, this tech has a lot to add to VR and AR. And I think, yeah, education is something I'm really interested in from the point of view of using these technologies. I'm not big into gaming particularly, but I think teaching people more things is always good.
It's fascinating. Yeah, so you could be the next Brian Cox or the next Carl Sagan, but doing it with, you know, taking something in your hand and, you know, bouncing it around, bouncing the sun up and down like a basketball.
Perhaps.
Neil Blue Dot in VR.
Yeah. I'm not sure I'm as big a showman as Carl Sagan is.
Oh, well, you'll need to team up with someone who talks too much. So,
go ahead.
So, Simon, you study computer science at the University of Bristol. What made you choose computer science? What got you in?
I think I'd just always been interested in it, I guess. It was just, I never really considered what I was going to do at university. I just always thought I'd do computer science. Thinking about it now, I didn't really consider other options. I just kind of went for computer science. It was something I'd always been interested in, and I'd always messed around with computers and always been the person that family members had asked for help. And I think they've got a real potential to, and as you've seen, they've shaped the world we live in today. And I think there's a lot of opportunity in computer science to kind of, it's a classic Silicon Valley cliche, but to make the world a better place. I think there's a lot of stuff that in our daily lives helps. And I think computers have got a real power to do that, without kind of being encumbered too much by politics and law and things like that. You can see technology making a difference. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of downsides, and living in Silicon Valley has been an interesting one to hear about the pushback from the damage Silicon Valley does. There's a lot of negatives associated with the area and the extortionate house prices that are caused by all these wealthy tech workers. But I think technology can do a lot to help out in the future. And we're going to need it in a world that's increasingly plagued by climate change and all these other issues.
So talking more about the Silicon Valley itself, recently there's been a few stories coming out about the cultural practices within Silicon Valley companies. So for example, Uber, or what was the other? There's been a few stories coming out.
Google, I think. They released the letter.
Do you think there is an overarching cultural problem in the Silicon Valley?
I think there exists one, but I haven't experienced it myself. Mm. So the company I'm working for, there's nothing. Everything's really nice there. Everyone's really nice, and there's a really good culture of stuff, and it's a fun place to work. But that said, I think there is definitely in Silicon Valley companies and in general, there's a culture. There's a very much kind of like a grown-up frat bros type thing with a lot of Silicon Valley startups, because they're these mainly guys coming out of universities and starting up businesses and receiving millions of dollars in funding for their idea and spending it in somewhat ludicrous ways. I think it's getting better, but yeah, there's definitely issues there.
I was going to ask what you think about startup culture in general, because startup culture and these little startup companies are something that's really arisen in the tech boom, and it's something you don't necessarily get any really exposure to in the biology world. What do you think about the general ideas of startups Like, is this just a waste of throwing millions of dollars on these newly graduated people who spend it in ludicrous ways?
I think startups are a really good thing because it's someone coming up with an idea and doing it and building it, usually from passion for the idea, and making something, and not just joining the ranks of another big company and being a kind of robot their whole lives. So I think they're a power for good. That said, there's a lot of excess probably in startups in Silicon Valley in particular, because there is just a lot of money floating around. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think they're a power for good, and there's a lot of, you know, good companies that do good stuff. And then it depends on your position. Like Facebook's an interesting one. They were, you know, a little startup one day, and they've now grown, and you could argue they're good, you could argue they're bad, you could argue they waste so much of our time keeping it, and the fake news thing and the politics thing. But then there's also, this year I've kept in touch with my family predominantly through Facebook Messenger and Facebook. It's a double-edged sword, I guess, and it remains to be seen how it will all turn out in the end. But I think tech has both sides, just like everything. There's a good and a bad side. Google's an interesting one because they are such a massive company nowadays, and they provide so much of everyone's information. And should they be allowed to account for 90% of the world's searches? Should that be something that we should let happen? Have they got a complete monopoly on it, or, you know, that's all kind of political questions, I guess. But there's a potential for them to do bad things.
Google is a very interesting company. I mean, it's crazy that they got started with a product that almost no one pays for. Like, and right now, you know, all their sort of like apps, their, you know, their most widely used Google Search and Gmail, completely and utterly free. Mm-hmm. But their advertisements and stuff like that, they've managed to, and YouTube, they've managed to make areas of profit in there and grown into this enormous company that just produces so much.
Yeah, there's a saying that if you're not paying for the service, then you're the product. And with Google, you're the product, and they sell you to the advertiser. And so your eyeballs are what's valuable. And that's very true, I think. And I think you're seeing more news websites, for example, move to a payment-based model, which I think is usually good. If the person is directly paying for something, then say it's a newspaper, they're not beholden to their advertisers, and they can criticize anyone equally as they should, and they can be honest, and they can say things without fear of advertisers saying, all right, we're not going to pay you any money because you criticized our parent company or whatever. So I think people paying for stuff directly is good, probably, but it's tricky to convince people to pay for something that's always been free in the past.
Well, isn't that's a difficult question, though, right? Because you have a lot of reputable news sources that are now putting paywalls up, and the non-reputable news sources are not putting paywalls up.
Yep.
And also, you know, isn't there a massive problem there? That
definitely, yeah, yeah. I don't know what the answer is to it, but there's definitely a problem there with more scandalous stuff gets more readers and gets more views of your adverts, and you make more money. So the more scandalous you can make something, whether it be true or not, is better.
Yeah.
And being beholden to your advertisers is a sort of a little mini crisis that YouTube went through recently, where they had PewDiePie being criticized by the Wall Street Journal for having, like, not PewDiePie being like the most subscribed person on YouTube. He was the Wall Street Journal put out an article saying that he condoned, like, Nazi speak and white supremacists, and that he was a white supremacist.
Does he?
No. They just basically took little clips of him making fun of sort of, like, some sort of, like, random Nazi stuff. You can research it for yourself. I won't be able to describe it as well. He put out a video describing it pretty well as well. I would recommend learning about the topic. But basically, the Wall Street Journal just took things out of context, and it appears like they were purposely looking through his videos for those things and kind of spliced them all together to paint a much different picture than what he actually is. And it resulted in a lot of YouTube advertisers completely pulling out of YouTube, and YouTube putting on much more strict guidelines for what can get monetized and what can't. And so now a lot of YouTube creators are having an enormous struggle because a lot of their stuff can't get monetized anymore. Mm. And it's only, and advertisers are sticking to much safer videos because they don't want to be associated with those or even have the chance of being associated with those videos. And so, and especially now with the things that have been happening in Charlottesville, I'm sure it's only going to escalate it more.
Well, they were having YouTube creators. YouTube is a really good example of where there's, well, for one thing, a clash of cultures. So the Wall Street Journal versus the online world, you know, they're two cultures that don't understand each other. A lot of editors within traditional newspapers won't understand YouTube and YouTube speak, etc. But YouTube's a good example of where perhaps a company like Google, which owns YouTube, is starting to squeeze on that creative thought. You know, creators are finding it more and more difficult, especially in the last few years, to make money from their videos. And that's because Google has been changing its rules. It used to be the fact you could make a living off YouTube if you had 100,000 subscribers and maybe 10,000 views per video. Nowadays, you realistically cannot do that. And it's quite a worrying trend that we're seeing in the tech world, moving towards high-end, large companies, you know, more like a traditional industry. Like, it's very difficult to break into the car industry. Do you think there's a risk that in the future that startup culture might actually be superseded by a large corporate culture?
I think that's definitely a risk in every space. Tech used to be one of the things where it was because it was a relatively new industry, it was quite easy to break into it. You didn't need massive amounts of money to get started. But I'd say, yeah, going forward, that's going to be a bigger issue. I think it's still better than a lot of industries, because to make a software product, all you need is a laptop and lots of time. And people can do that still. You don't need like a manufacturing plant like you might for a car company. But I still think, yeah, going forward, it's going to be more and more difficult to do that. On your point about the Wall Street Journal and the PewDiePie stuff, there's some interesting software that Adobe have recently demoed, which they can take about a 20-minute recording of someone's voice, and you can then type in what you want them to say, and they'll say that.
Right, and it sounds like exactly like them.
Wow. And there's other technology they're working on, which is to do the same thing with video, and they've shown, I'm not sure if it's Adobe or someone else, but they've shown you can take a footage of, say, Donald Trump speaking, and you can analyze that, and then I can sit in front of a webcam and I can say things, and it will animate his face the same as mine is animated and say the words I say in his voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be something going forward with fake news, the whole fake news thing. It's going to be a lot easier for people to create videos and photos and audio that is doctored, not just like, you know, normally you can do a bit of Photoshop, but going forward it's going to be a lot harder for people to tell what's real and what's not. If you can doctor a video and some audio well enough to not be detected, then it becomes nigh on impossible to tell what's real and what's not.
It's true.
That's going to have massive effects on CCTV, right? Because they're pretty grainy anyway. And so can you rely in a court of evidence on CCTV?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. There's going to have to be some sort of, I don't know, encryption or some sort of watermark proof.
Some sort of signing, yeah.
Yeah, that proves that this is like a original undoctored footage. But the only thing is, you know, like, it's going to be a nuclear race war.
It definitely is, yeah.
You know, where the people who are trying to doctor things are going to be coming up with new technologies to use at the same time that those preventative measures are. It's exactly what you see with, like, viruses and antiviruses right now.
The traditional sort of, like, movie cliche of I've been recording you is going to mean nothing in the future.
Yeah, because you can just type in a paragraph what you want them to say, and then it automatically produces a video that is impossible to tell the difference between real and not.
Oh.
And, you know, the most popular kind of stuff, like you see with, like, Snapchat with face filters and stuff, that's the basis for this, like, growing technology, and that's just the beginning of it.
Yeah, suddenly you can't believe your eyes anymore. You can't trust your eyes and what you see and what you hear. You have to, I guess you have to trust the source of wherever that video comes from. Mm-hmm. You've got to trust that they are purporting the real thing, but it's going to become increasingly hard to tell what's real and what's not. And I think that's a real problem for politics and everything in the world.
And the problem with trusting sources is that's where our human side comes in, because that's where all of our biases come in terms of what we trust and what we think is real, because we're not solely based on the logic. We're based on, like, we have confirmation biases where we seek out what we already perceive to be true, and only further to just solidify that thought in our mind rather than actually find conflicting arguments to try and find the truth.
Do you think the Silicon Valley is taking responsibility for the fact that it is contributing towards a post-truth society?
Hard to say. A little bit, but not as much as they should, I think. I'm not sure what the solutions are to a lot of the problems with technology. One of the things we can get into if you want is artificial intelligence and how that's going to change things and how that's going to upend the way the economy and therefore society. I think that's
going to
be...
So this is basically the fact that AI is going to take the jobs of mainly working class people. For example, in the driving industry, truck drivers, as we say, lorry drivers.
Taxi drivers.
Yeah.
That's where Uber's going. Uber is just using people as a means to an end. Yeah. They want to have autonomous driving vehicles. And once they have that, they're going to get rid of all those people drivers.
So I guess there's two questions. The two questions they're both very difficult questions. One is, how do we deal with these massive changes in employment? And the second thing is should the Silicon Valley take any... Is it the Silicon Valley's responsibility to take any responsibility for this? Or should it just be like, we've been creating this technology, it's up to politicians to deal with it, or whatever?
Yeah, that's a really tricky one. So globalism is a big cause of this problem. Basically, like if entrepreneurs here, or if the government in the US outlaws artificial intelligence, then fine, like, you've outlawed artificial intelligence, it's not going to cause problems in the US to start with, at least, but China are going to develop it, or any other country are going to develop it, and suddenly their economy is so much more powerful and they're able to do more stuff, they're more efficient. I think inevitably the technology is going to advance. There's no way you can stop that. People will innovate. It's a case of regulating that properly and trying not to let it get too far. I think, I'm not an economist, but the universal basic income seems like something we're going to work towards. And I think artificial intelligence can lead to like a real utopia where people don't have to work as much. They can focus on the things they want to do or the things they like to do, and they can, spend time helping people who are less fortunate than them, or they can spend their time, hanging out with old people who are lonely, or anything like that. All these things that if people have more time to do, they might do, and the things that you want to do on a daily basis, or that you just don't have the time to because you've got to work 9 to 5 and then you're tired and you want to spend time with your family or whatever. So I think AI has the potential to allow us all to live lives of happily skipping around in the woods and painting and telling stories.
Do you think US working culture is ready for this?
No. So I think some countries will get it right, and they will have high taxes on big corporations and on kind of like a robot tax, basically, and they'll use that to fund social systems to provide for people. And I think the other way that it could go that worries me is that the really skilled workers who don't get replaced by artificial intelligence will remain, and they'll earn lots of money for doing that, and then there'll just be entire sectors of society, so taxi drivers, and there's a bricklaying robot demoed a while ago, so lots of kind of lower skilled jobs will get replaced, and entire sectors of people will just suddenly not have much money and will just have nothing to
social
do.
Upheaval.
They'll
vote for Trump.
And if we can't tell when a human doctor is a video with your voice and picture, how are we going to know the difference between when an AI decides it wants to doctor your voice and picture?
That's a whole different...
I've been reading a book on that called Super Intelligence by a guy called Nick Bostrom, and it's all about when we make... So the theory goes, if we as humans with a certain level of intelligence can make a computer as clever as us, or maybe even slightly cleverer, then that computer, and if it's called general intelligence, the idea of something can do any task that a human could do as well as a human could do it, and that those tasks include making computers that can do that. So if we can make something as smart as us, then it can make the thing that's the next level of smartness up, and then the device that it makes or the software that it makes that is intelligent can make the next level up of intelligence. And very quickly you get this, it's called a superintelligence explosion, where you very quickly go from a subhuman intelligence to human intelligence, and there's no reason why it shouldn't skip straight past that and out to something a lot cleverer than us.
Is hardware a bit of an issue there? Like, as in, if you want to create a more intelligent computer, you need to create more intelligent hardware ultimately, and to do that you need to physically give a computer hardware, like some implement or some sort.
Yeah, that's certainly true, but we are building bigger and bigger supercomputers and clusters of computers to run artificial intelligent programs on. And so I think there's no reason that we can't create a device or a system as intelligent as a human, because all our brains are is a collection of chemistry and electricity and some connections. And it's not going to be an easy thing to do, but we've already made some big leaps in the last 20 years or so.
And even if a single computer isn't powerful enough, with networking and a powerful AI, it can use multiple computers, thousands of computers as one, can coordinate it like a group of computers is a single brain, and it's using them all together in synchrony in order to do much larger things.
So the comparison that Nick Bostrom draws in the book is between gorillas and us. And so gorillas and apes in general, they tend to be much stronger than us, much tougher than us. They'd beat us in a fight if we were just both unarmed. But the reason that we can decide whether gorillas live or die is because we've got better brains, and we can make tools, and we can outsmart them, and we can think what they're going to do, and we can account for that. And so the idea is, if you create a super intelligent system that is more intelligent than humans, that it can outthink us, and everything that we try and do can outthink it. And it may be that it starts off and we intentionally make it super intelligent because we want it to, organize our tax system or drive our cars around the road, and it starts off with this goal that we give it. And so he used the example of if you tell a computer that its objective is to make humans smile the whole time.
Oh God.
To make people smile as much as possible, which sounds like a relatively good goal.
Drugs.
And so the computer will think, well, my task is to make people smile, so the best way to do that is to capture everyone and put electrodes in their face that stimulate the smiling muscles. And so there's this real problem that you've got to specify what the objective for the computer to do. You've got to specify that really well.
One thing that I find fascinating about this is that reading 1950s and 1960s science fiction is they've predicted exactly this. And some aspects of it, when I read it 10 years ago, seemed ridiculous at the time. For example, the idea of a computer being able to come up with a face of its own and a voice of its own. But from what we've just been talking about recently, that's definitely going to be within the grasp when we create a computer that's clever enough to sort of replicate the human. It will be able to have its own face and its own voice. And on two aspects I find that amazing. I find it amazing that that could happen. And I also find it amazing that Isaac Asimov, Robert A. Heinlein, who else? Orson Scott Card. They've predicted this in the 80s, the 60s, and the 50s. They predicted computers that were clever enough to replicate humans, become politicians, become leaders and friends, for example, that they'll have emotions, I guess. They'll exist within very large networks. In most of these science fiction novels, they exist between planets, across empires. The limits of their thoughts are actually caused by the limits of speed of light communication between different star systems. And it's just absolutely astounding that we are actually, obviously we haven't quite got to the separate star systems yet, but it's absolutely astounding that that future could actually come about.
I saw this really interesting video about this texting app that was released where it would study the language of a person and be able to eventually replicate and text exactly like a single person texts. So there was a case where there was a couple and the texting app had studied the man's sort of way of the way of communication with the wife, and then the husband died, but the girl was still able to text the app, and it would reply exactly how he would, and how And it would even, like, initiate conversation exactly like he would, you know, at the same times and cadence and frequency. And it's just so weird to see all these things coming together into this inevitable end of, like, AI overlord.
It's like that Black Mirror episode where you could throw a sponge into a bath and it becomes, like, you know, your dead relative or whatever. It's
terrible.
In many ways, it's going to lead to interesting philosophical questions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Shall we take it back a little bit to those two questions?
I've got one thing about, so human-level AI has been 20 years off for the last 50 years or so. People have been saying, so your point about the science fiction writers, that they probably were in a similar situation to us now, where they thought it was, you know, in the near future that human-level AI was going to appear. So we may not see it in the next 20 years. It might be, you know, it might never happen in our lifetimes.
Maybe it's just a limit. We'll always be approaching, but never hit it.
Isn't there a problem that there's a difference between a computer as powerful as a human brain and a computer that replicates a human brain, right? So we could create a computer that's better than a human before we create a computer that's like a human.
So that's one of the things with people often miss the point with AI. It isn't necessarily to create systems that we don't... There's not really any point to start with, at least, to emulate humans. We don't want to have a human, because humans are flawed in various ways. They get tired, they need sleep, they have emotions, which as a productive machine is kind of to our detriment, I guess, from the point of view of achieving tasks. So a lot of the current stuff isn't... We're not trying to recreate humans, we're trying to create machines that can do certain tasks that humans do well that computers don't do well, and we want to create systems that do that.
Not to mention that to be able to replicate the brain, we have to know how it works.
So we're
definitely going to produce an AI that is better than it before we even understand how the brain even works to emulate it. True.
So Simon, hypothetical situation: you're a lawmaker in the year 2050. There's this computer scientist who's coming up to you saying, "I have this computer which is more intelligent than a human being. Should I be allowed to plug it into the internet?" Do you think that there, at that point, it would be safer for humanity to actually limit computational intelligence, or do you think that would be a foolish thing to do?
I don't know. There's a lot of people on both sides of the debate. So there's Elon Musk is someone who's quite worried about AI, and he started a group called the Open AI Foundation, which are doing research into AI out in the open, because he's worried about a certain company, maybe that be you or someone else, achieving this and having kind of ultimate power over the world, I guess. And he says it's as big a threat as nuclear weapons are. And you can see with the increase in cyber attacks, for example, like that could be like they pose a real risk to countries around the world and cause a lot of damage. Mm-hmm. And you could imagine a super intelligent computer system being incredibly good at attacking computer systems. And that would be the ideal place to use it, because it doesn't need a physical manifestation of itself. It can use the internet to access stuff. So he's very worried about that. And I'm not sure what the solutions are. I think the solutions are to think about stuff early and to have done research into how we can specify the objectives of artificial intelligences well before we make them. So once kind of Pandora's box is open, it might be too late, but if we can think about how to keep a lid on it, then we might be able to avoid that. But in answer to your question, don't know.
There seems to be two different competing visions of the future. The future propagated by Elon Musk is sort of the more traditional science fiction future of us becoming an interplanetary species and exploring far-off worlds, etc., etc., like the Star Trek kind of future. Mm-hmm. And then there is another future that I think is only propagated by a few, but is much more abstract in its sort of, you know, ambitions, if you see what I mean. The idea of the aim of humanity is to create an intelligence that betters us. And ultimately, we are just a propagator that happens to be biological of a universal intelligence, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Because isn't Facebook founder, what's his name?
Zuckerberg.
He's kind of more relaxed about the whole idea of computers, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely.
So, taking it back to those two questions, So the first question we've kind of tackled a little bit, well, not really, but, you know, a little bit, which was, how do we deal with this? The other question is, should the Silicon Valley take any responsibility? Should the people who create these technologies take any responsibility, or is it something that they can just sort of not worry about, do you think?
I think people should always take responsibility for what they do, and I don't think it's okay to do something and then say, well, no one said it was illegal, so I did it. I don't think that's the way to work. I don't think that leads to a good state of things. So I think Silicon Valley, referring to Silicon Valley as a thing doesn't really make sense, because it's people everywhere.
Yeah.
It's not just Silicon Valley. There's lots of companies that aren't based here that are doing stuff as well. So tech in general, I think, should take responsibility for stuff. I think there should be... It's really hard to say, because everything in the world's driven by money when mm-hmm. it comes to business. In an ideal world, you'd have companies lobbying the government to... limit themselves would be that's the problem where the money side comes in. You'd have companies like Uber lobbying for a universal basic income so that when they make all their drivers unemployed, that their drivers still get paid. But that's not going to happen, because that would mean that Uber would get taxed more. And so, I think Silicon Valley should, and companies should take responsibility for their things and the problems they cause, but I think they won't, because there's no incentive for them to do it other than they'll do whatever gives them good press.
Mm.
But big companies are big companies, and they're all about shareholder value.
All about that dosh.
Yeah, which is a shame. And that's something that may change going forward. The nature of business gets changed by politics, because it's a necessity to stop the kind of problems caused by big business. But who knows?
A final question about Britain. So you work for a startup that was started up in the Bristol Valley, I guess. The
Silicon Gorge, they call it.
Silicon Gorge.
Do you think that the tech centre that we see in what we call the Silicon Valley, do you think there are realistic competitors around the world, or is this small slice of California really the centre for the considerable future?
I think it is a big... center for it, but you see a lot of companies moving away or not coming here to start with but mainly it comes down to price. It's incredibly expensive to have an office out here just through land prices. It's expensive to employ people here, because you had to pay people a lot more, because prices for houses are a lot higher and prices for everything are just crazy. So it's expensive to be here, and there's a lot of people who I think the area has grown a lot in recent years. Even in the last 10 or 15 years, it's changed a lot, and it's got a lot busier, and the traffic is awful. So it's becoming a less good place to live because of this influx of people. It's very crowded, and the infrastructure isn't there to support them. So I think people are tending not to... It's becoming a less attractive place to work, I think. You see a lot of people moving to San Diego, which is still has the benefits of California, the sunshine and the seas and the beaches, and is a bit less crowded. And worldwide, you're seeing more expansion outside of Silicon Valley.
Is there anywhere really surprising where you're seeing tech expansion that you would not expect?
I think Eastern Europe's quite big for tech at the moment. I think there's a lot of stuff going on there, because it's a lot cheaper for people to live there. And it's a lot more easy to sit in a basement in Eastern Europe and develop the next company when your costs are a lot lower than it is to rent a room in San Francisco for $2,000 a month.
Well, you can rent a room in Warsaw for a lot less than that.
Yeah, that's probably not good reasoning, actually, now I think about it. But yeah, Eastern Europe's certainly somewhere where there's a lot of skilled people coming up, good technical universities there, and doing interesting stuff.
Absolutely fantastic. And would you say that... I keep on thinking of new questions, but would you say that most people who are starting up, are they starting up straight out of university, or do they spend a bit of time in another company before starting up?
I don't know for sure, really. The guy who started our company came out of a PhD on this stuff. This was his PhD project, basically. He graduated from his, well, finished his PhD a couple of months ago.
Yeah, at Bristol?
6 or 7 years after starting it. Yeah, at Bristol, yeah. So I'd say from a... If you're coming straight out of university, you tend to have very few commitments, and it's easy to decide to, you know, go shut yourself in a room for a few months and develop something than if you've got a job and a family and you know, all these additional responsibilities that make it hard to quit your job that's paying you money and suddenly have no income at all and be kind of in a startup. And the reality is most startups fail, so it's a risky thing to do.
You heard it here, kids. Don't get a job. Don't get a family. Start up straight out of university.
Because you have a probability of 0.23% that you're going to hit it big. Well, that probably is a good time to start wrapping it up.
We'd like to thank you very much, Simon Partridge, for being a wonderful guest on our show. Possibly the final guest we ever have.
Very possibly. Thank you so much for bringing in your amazing acoustic device. This is going to be crazy, and I'm really interested to see how this applies to not only VR, but kind of our whole world.
It will be available in all good electronic stores at some point in the future. Well, thank you very much, Simon. And yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure meeting you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the 6th episode of From Newts to Newton.
If you have any questions, queries, comments, or suggestions, please don't hesitate to send them to fromnewtstonewton, all one word, @gmail.com.
We'd like to thank again our special guest, Simon Partridge, for giving us an amazing talk about virtual reality and haptic feedback using acoustic vibrations of the air.
See us next week for the last episode of From Newts to Newton.